Welcome back. Here's our next story from today's Des Moines Register. And I'm going to go back to the opinion section. They have some good, interesting articles in there today. This is a Your Turn article written by Walter Souza. He's a guest columnist. Guns don't care about children. Killing is their job. A human-made storm is ravaging the United States. It struck 630 times in 2023. The eye of the storm encircled Perry, Iowa on January 4th, which was the day of school for the new year. On that morning, Dylan Butler, a 17-year-old Perry High School student, shot and killed an 11-year-old Perry middle schooler, Amir Jolif. Butler also shot and wounded several staff members and students, including Perry High School principal, Dan Marburger, who was trying to distract him so the students could escape. Marburger died 10 days later after being shot while he was trying to save his students. Quote, as I heard of a gunman, I instantly had a feeling my dad would be a victim as he would put himself in harm's way for the benefit of kids and his staff, Marburger's daughter Claire wrote on Facebook. It is believed Butler died of a self-inflicted gunshot wound. It's impossible to fathom what the families of those killed and the injured must be going through. Amir was shot 3 times. Images of Amir in the media ran through my mind on my drive to his visitation. I arrived at Perry's Caldwell Parish Funeral Home Chapel in the early afternoon. Adults and kids were there. The kids' sobs were a testament that Amir will be terribly missed. 3 comfort dogs were brought to the chapel for support. I wished it was just a bad dream, yet the tragedy was real. To be a child in the United States is to live in great danger. Guns ended the lives of 2,590 American children in 2023. In this beacon of hope, spaces meant to be safe for kids are now their potential killing zone. The carnage is real. I have imagined Amir waking up that doomed morning, excited to be back in school after the winter break. Perhaps he meant to go to band activities after eating breakfast. Perhaps he meant to have a chat with his best friend after breakfast. Quote, I am sick and tired of people seeming to not care about kids or others because they are staunchly against any gun regulation. And instead, states are loosening gun laws, said a friend. My friend is not alone feeling this way. The anger is real. In the United States, it's just not the adults who own guns. Kids can also own guns before they are old enough to vote, old enough to drink, old enough to smoke. Who buys a 9-year-old a gun? a friend lamented, after a nephew received a 22 caliber rifle for Christmas. Quote, please promise that you will never pick up that gun when you are angry, my friend implored the nephew. The insanity of guns is real, and we can't replace the precious lives lost to guns. Quote, in his relatively short time with us, Amir managed to touch the lives of countless individuals, leaving behind a legacy of love, compassion, and advocacy for those in need, read part of Amir's obituary. Imagine a child coming into the world, fragile, peaceful, innocent, beautiful. Imagine holding the child in your arms. You watch the child fall asleep in your arms. You realize life has entrusted you with the star. You realize you would do anything to protect the child, even if it means dying so the child could be safe. You watch the child grow. Legs and arms gain strength. Then comes crawling. Then an attempt to walk. Then the first step. Then the first fall. Then standing up to try to walk again. Over and over again, the child walks. The child says the first word. The child catches a cold. The child has a fever. There are many sleepless nights to care for your sick child. Soon you see the child off to his or her first day in kindergarten. The heart breaks, but the heart is proud. Will the child be okay in school? Will the child make new friends? Never will my child be injured or killed in school. The child grows more, first grade, second grade, fifth grade. Many play dates happen through the years. Many show and tells, many trick or treats. You create or buy superhero costumes. You see the joy in the child's face to be presented as their best superhero. Oh, how you've worried about how the child eating too many candies. Oh, how you've worried about the child's safety, which is why you walked with the child house to house, even on bone-chilling evenings. The child grows more. Then comes visits to amusement parks. Oh, how you've worried about the safety of the rides your kids loved. Oh, how you worried about the child eating too much ice cream. All you want is for the child to have the best experience. You sit with the child to watch the Polar Express, Finding Nemo, Ice Age, or Soul, all movies. The child grows more. Your love for the child also grows. You still wish your precious child will grow to become an adult. You have his or her own family. To have his or her own family. To be alive. Nonsense, said a politician. More guns, says the gun lobby. Sure, says the gunman. Kill, says the gun. Obliterate, says the bullet. Your loved one bleeds to death. Your precious child bleeds to death. Only in America, the insanity of gun violence. And Walter Souza of Ames, Iowa, writes frequently on the intersections of spirituality, anti-racism, and social justice.
Well, I'm going to stay on the opinion section, and it's not as powerful as one that Mark just shared with you, but this one is relevant as well. It's by Randy Evans, who is a retired journalist, is also the executive director of the Iowa Freedom of Information Council. And the headline states, Iowa needs to stop creeping secrecy over names. The increasing secrecy by Iowa law enforcement and their lawyers about identifying people by name raises important questions underlying public confidence in the critical work of first responders. The question deals with whether police can or should refuse to identify persons involved in incidents and crimes. Despite Iowa's history of openness about crimes and accidents, with increasing frequency, public officials refuse to provide names of people who end up in these events, whether as victims or perpetrators. A few examples illustrate this issue. Des Moines police officers encountered a tense standoff early the morning after Christmas in 2022. The incident involved a 16-year-old boy with a handgun. The events unfolded inside the apartment where his grandmother lived. His mother and stepfather lived a couple of doors away. In the 5 minutes after officers arrived, having been summoned by the stepfather, officers pleaded 70 times with the teen to put down the gun, according to a report from the Iowa Attorney General's office. The standoff ended when the youth raised the gun toward the officers, resulting in them firing 14 shots that struck him in the head and torso. The Attorney General's report identified the dead boy only by his initials, TJ. The Des Moines City Attorney ordered police not to make public their body camera video from the standoff at the teen's name, despite the willingness of officials to do so. The lawyers claimed releasing the name and video would violate Iowa's juvenile justice law because the teen had not been charged with any crime in connection with the standoff. Of course, authorities seldom prosecute the dead. Keep this supposed legal analysis in mind and think back to the mass shooting at Perry High School. Within hours of the tragedy, law officers released the name of Dylan Butler, 17, the student who fatally shot one student and injured four other students and three school employees before he took his own life. The day after the shootings, officials made public the name of Amir Joliffe, 11, a sixth grader who died from gunshot wounds. Then high school principal Dan Marburger, 56, hailed as a hero for protecting students, died from his wounds. No one asserted Perry Police and the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation violated any statute by making public the shooter's name or the name of the sixth grader who was killed. However, officials have not made public the names of any of the other of the survivors who were injured. In its nonsense to believe officials acted improperly or against public interest in identifying the shooter or in naming the sixth grader or principal, for anyone to assert otherwise makes a mockery of government transparency and implies Iowans are so detached from their communities they do not want to know who was involved in this tragedy. But think back to last May and news of a tragic accident in Iowa City when a motor vehicle struck and fatally injured an Iowa National Guard soldier, Corey Height of Cedar Rapids was jogging near West High School when the vehicle hit him. Iowa City Police refused for more than a month to confirm the identity of the driver, the 16-year-old son of University of Iowa men's basketball coach Fran McCaffrey, because he is a juvenile and had not been charged with any legal infraction then. The younger McCaffrey was convicted of a failure to yield charge and was fined $1,000. Then go back to the weekend before the Iowa City accident when two classmates of the young McCaffrey were involved in what state troopers said was a street race. The two teens, both 17, failed to heed a stop sign and collided with a car traveling through the intersection. That car's driver, Jennifer Russell, 22, of Waterloo, died a short time later. The names of the two street racers and a passenger in one of the cars were released the next day by the Iowa State Patrol. Cases where police withhold names continue to increase with the secrecy maintained for inexplicable reasons. Some cases involve fatal traffic accidents. Others involve people shot by police. Some involve people who died in drowning or similar tragedy. All these incidents raise important questions. Why are some people's names made public while other people's names are not? The legislature enacted a law more than 40 years ago requiring Iowa law enforcement agencies to release the date, time, specific location, and what the law calls the immediate facts and circumstances about a crime or other incident to which police are sent. A 1990 legal opinion from the Iowa Attorney General reminds government officials there is a presumption of disclosure of these facts except in those unusual circumstances where disclosure would plainly and seriously jeopardize the investigation or pose clear and present danger to the safety of an individual. The opinion stated victim names are one of the immediate facts covered by the disclosure requirement. The lack of consistency from town to town, county to county, and within state, this inconsistency leads to suspicion. Young McCaffrey's case received special treatment because of his famous father, something the two street racers did not receive because their families are not well known. Indeed, some in Iowa City speculate the racers got different treatment because they are black. Keeping the actions of government employees transparent and open to scrutiny is vital to maintaining public trust and confidence in our government institutions. Accountability requires an informed public that obtains reliable information from public officials rather than relying on rumor, gossip, and theories woven on social media. Another important element to releasing victim names often gets overlooked. Iowans have seen an outpouring of emotional and financial support that has warmed the hearts and tempered the pain of the victims in the Perry School of Tragedy, in the death of Iowa National Guard Sergeant in Iowa City, and in the recent drowning of a 9-year-old boy in a pond in Waukee, where police refused to identify him. All of this underscores why access to accurate information from law enforcement is so important. It lies at the heart of being a community of caring and informed neighbors. Again, that was by Randy Evans. Back to you, Mark.
One more opinion section. It's written by Rachel Manuel Bruns, titled "Iowa Hospitals Must Stop Unlawful Drug Testing After Births." The Register's, quote, "What Patients Should Know About Hospital Drug Testing," unquote, missed some key information that may help families disrupt the illegal maternal and newborn drug screening practices taking place at Iowa's hospitals and clinics. The Supreme Court ruling in 2001, Ferguson versus Charleston, made it clear that prenatal drug testing without specific informed consent is unlawful. However, this practice is still happening at some Iowa clinics and hospitals when urine is gathered for testing of urinary tract infections or to help urine glucose or protein levels. Such practices are not only unlawful, but they create mistrust of the medical system, which puts the lives of moms and babies at risk. Regarding newborn drug testing, Iowa Code Section 232.77 states very narrow criteria for drug testing of newborns without parental consent. According to the law, for a newborn to be tested without parental consent, is a practitioner must document, quote, physical or behavioral symptoms of the effects of exposure to illicit drugs, in parentheses. Instead of following Iowa code, many Iowa hospitals have implemented their own set of criteria for drug testing newborns without parental consent. Some of these criteria includes if the birthing person has been a victim of domestic violence, does not have custody of one or more children, has had an out-of-hospital birth or free birth, has suffered placental abruption, has physical attributes of abuse, or has unassisted birth. For Donlin family, a false positive drug test of their newborn led to a distressing 8-month ordeal with Iowa Child Protective Services. Having an unplanned, unassisted home birth is not a demonstration of, quote, physical or behavioral symptoms, unquote, of drug use, as required by Iowa law to justify testing the Donlan newborn without consent, nor is it following the Iowa neonatal quality collaborative guidelines for newborn assessment. Iowa hospitals and the Iowa Department of Health and Human Services need to get their act together and stop unlawful drug testing of mothers and their newborns. Unlawfully testing for reasons outside of federal law or state code is a violation of civil liberties that harms families, often results in discriminatory practices, and directs taxpayer resources away from the children and families that may actually need support and intervention. Bobby?
Right, jumping to the business section, a section with which I'm not always familiar. Headline says, Riverbend fends off another high-density rezoning request. Neighbors pleased to see work progressing, but adding units not fair to area. This is byline to Addison Lathers, who is runs a regular column about what's happening locally. Another Riverbend rental property has lost its bid to increase its capacity. Michael Clayton of Clayton Enterprises asked that his apartment building at 1726 Oakland Avenue be allowed to place three units in its basement, bringing the building's total to nine. The request comes on the heels of a similar attempt by Starlink LLC, a subsidiary of the Des Moines-based Credo Capital, to lease seven apartments in a converted home nearby after the expiration of a time-limited certificate to use it for multifamily housing. The City Council rejected the request in late November, and the city's Zoning Board of Adjustment rejected Credo's appeal in December. Kathy Hellstern, president of the Riverbend Neighborhood Association, spoke against rezoning the Oakland Avenue property at a Plan and Zoning Commission meeting January 18th, saying that While neighbors were pleased to see work on the building progressing, adding units wouldn't be fair to the area. She said, "Our feeling is that packing more people into existing structures is only beneficial to the landlords and property owners, not to the people who are packed into the buildings or the neighbors living in arbitrarily dense areas so that somebody can make more money per square foot," she said. The Oakland Avenue building is not currently occupied. It was damaged in a fire in 2018 and has since landed on Des Moines' nuisance property list. Clayton, represented by financial manager Clinton Ackerberg, pursued adding units to make the property more profitable, noting that working on historic property has driven up the cost of the project. He purchased the building in 2006 for $92,500. Members of the board asked why Clayton hadn't applied for historic tax credits. Ackerberg said he didn't have an experience with the process. Ackerberg said, "That would have been a great thing to pursue out of the gate, but I don't feel like we have time now to go down that road to appease the neighborhood." Since 1992, the Riverbend Neighborhood Action Plan has called for a reduction in density to help revitalize the area and recover from decades of disinvestment and negligent landlords. And Haymarket Square sold for $16.5 million. Block Real Estate Services and Score Development are looking to spruce up an aging shopping center near Merle Hay Mall with modern storefronts and signage. They acquired the Haymarket Square Shopping Center, bordering the Beaverdale and Merle Hay neighborhoods, in December for $16.5 million. The collection of parcels is valued over $24.4 million by the Polk County Assessor's Office and includes a detached grocery store vacant since the closing of Price Chopper in fall of 2022, a strip mall and restaurants El Patron, Authentic Mexican Cuisine, and Buffalo Wild Wings in a parking lot outbuildings. A listing on commercial real estate LoopNet shows plans for renovations as well as additional pad-style structures for restaurant and retail use. The two Kansas City metro-based groups are not newcomers to the Des Moines area, Des Moines Metro. Block Real Estate Services is partnering with Ruan Center Corporation and Fouch Brothers to convert to Ruan Center, a landmark downtown building, a Des Moines office building, into an apartment building. It also was involved in the redevelopment of the Equitable Building into multifamily housing in 2016. Score Development also revamped Westtown Center at 1400 through 1650 22nd Street in West Des Moines. And in other business news, ICYMI starts Right Here Plans Youth Housing and School Project. A year after the shootings that left two of its students dead and its founder severely wounded, Des Moines Starts Right Here Alternative School Program is planning an expansion. Founder William Holmes, who also goes by Will Keeps, says he aims to convert the former Elam Christian Fellowship in the East Village into a school with 18 apartments for students struggling with homelessness. The $9.8 million project also could house apprenticeship programs and mental health services. Holmes said he intends to keep the facility where the shootings occurred on Southwest Fifth Avenue, but that I kept losing kids because they didn't have any place to stay. With the new building, he said, we want to cut some of that red tape and put their housing, education, and wraparound services in the same building. Built in 1956 and remodeled in 1960, the structure at 525 East 9th Street that is slated to house a residential facility was home to Elam Christian Fellowship before the church merged with the Drake Neighborhood's Hope Des Moines in 2022. Elam will maintain ownership until Starts Right Here has the funds to purchase the property. Developer and former Iowa State Senator Jack Hatch is leading the project, which would be open before 2026.
And I'm not going to read this article, but in the Iowa Life, there is a article about in Johnston, there's a mansion listed at $5.5 million that has a golf course and a private beach. And the pictures are absolutely amazing. They show three pictures of the interior, a dining room, an entryway that leads into a home office, a bedroom that features a fireplace. But the main picture is this gorgeous picture of a panoramic view that's amazing with all this landscaping of pine trees and the circle driveway and the house that looks humongous. 26 acres, a 9-hole golf course and a private pond with a beach. Live in luxury. 5.5 million home in Johnston. Yeah, all I think of is the mowing and the snow blowing in the winter, and this year would have been terrible. Anyway, this is another article, and this might be something that's touching at your situation. Winter deluge highlights mail woes. Complaints about delays come amid USPS losses. The recent series of deadly storms across the country slowed mail delivery to a crawl, frustrating people and businesses. It's the latest havoc befalling the U.S. Postal Service as lawmakers from Washington State to Texas express concerns about chronic mail delays. The mounting grievances come as the Postal Service reported a net income loss of $6.5 billion in fiscal year 2023. Postal Service spokesperson Jim McKean attributed the drop to inflation and civil service retirement costs. Total mail and package volume dropped by about 9% in 1 year, according to the Postal Service's 2023 report to Congress. Though it is a government agency, the Postal Service is generally self-funded and hasn't collected enough revenues to cover its expenses and debt for more than 15 years. The Postal Service announced a 10-year plan in 2021 to get its debt-ridden finances turned around. It plans to build back its financial viability through slower delivery, price hikes, and process optimization. The service maintains it generally delivers promptly, noting the average delivery takes less than 3 days. However, McKean said deliveries may continue to be affected through January as storms persist in some regions. The service has issued alerts about delays and reminded residents in several states to clear snow and ice from sidewalks and around mailboxes. The Postal Service isn't the only delivery service having problems. FedEx shipments were halted in hundreds of towns across 6 states due to the storms, the company said last week. While problems are reported in many places, the outcry from Houston has particularly been loud. Shannon Wilpitz, co-founder of Upper Room Candle Company, said she has completely lost faith in the Postal Service after a month of late deliveries. About 10 packages have been delayed over a week, Wilpitz said. The order for one customer in Metro Houston traveled to Dallas, Houston, and out of state to Atlanta, according to the online tracker. Wilpitz said she dropped off the order as priority mail on January 9th, and it hadn't arrived 2 weeks later. Wilpitz said several of the delayed orders came from first-time customers as her business was growing. Quote, "It's those people I'm concerned about," she said. "They don't know if that's just the way we do business." Wilpitz said she switched to UPS this past week and doesn't foresee going back. Quote, "You don't want to be burning your bridges," she said, "because we're so small, every single customer matters." U.S. Representative Al Green, Democrat from Texas, said he has received nearly 100 calls from people dismayed about Postal Service delays. He told USA Today the cases he has seen largely boil down to one office, the Missouri City Center, roughly 20 miles south of Houston. In one case, a resident's 1,600 wedding dress went missing. It was never found, Green said, and the woman had to buy another. Quote, "I am not going to contend that this was stolen, but I do think that it's an unusual circumstance," he said. Multiple other packages have seemed to arrive at the Missouri City office, according to online tracking updates, but then somehow get lost in ways that are inexplicable, he said. Green said he's seeking a tour of the facility and has urged the Postal Service to open a customer service line for the Missouri City branch. The Postal Service can't be a closed society. It needs to have transparency, he said. And he has one concern, possibly even more pressing than a wedding dress. Green said he hopes to get the delivery problems resolved before primary elections in March to prevent problems with mail-in ballots. Quote, "It would be a shame for the election to be thrown into some sort of questionable circumstances because the Postal Service did not deliver mail timely and appropriately," Green said. He added that he still supported the Postal Service, blaming the recent problems on policy and administration. McKean told USA Today the Postal Service had added staff and implemented new processes to address root causes of sporadic issues for mail delivery in Houston. Quote, "We want customers to know that we continue the expansion of our operations in Houston area because of increased volume, and we are adding additional capacity with the new facility to improve service," McKean said. He added that Houston was also affected by recent storms. McKean apologized and said customers, quote, "should already see improvements in delivery as we work through these issues. Lawmakers around the country have been getting an earful from constituents and forwarding the complaints. U.S. Representatives Susan Delbean and Rick Larson, both Democrats from Washington, sent a letter to Postmaster General Louis DeJoy about persistent mail delays during the holiday season. Delbean said January 13th, it followed a July letter complaining about chronic delays, she added. Minnesota senators introduced legislation last month aimed at improving Postal Service delivery, tracking, and accountability. Representative Abigail Spanberger, Democrat from Virginia, said in December she received more than 1,300 complaints about mail delays. Virginia officials asked the Postal Service to hold a town hall to address concerns about chronic delays and mail theft. WTVR-TV reported the request was denied. And I've had so many complaints from people because I did used to work at the post office, but I, you know, they said it just went downhill when I retired. If they only knew.
I agree. I agree. I'm going to jump back to the sports section where you don't usually have articles like this, but it's interesting and it involves the gambling net that was set by Iowa officials last year and caught a lot of athletes in it. Headline says ISU's dresser, Iowa's brands rail against DCI in gambling probe. This is from USA Today, actually, network. The University of Iowa and Iowa State University wrestling teams were hit hard by the state's sports gambling investigation. The Hawkeyes lost four key cogs in their lineup. The Cyclones lost a Big 12 champion. The Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation Probe resulted in two dozen athletes and student managers facing criminal charges and led to NCAA investigations and suspensions. All of the Iowa and ISU wrestlers caught up in this probe are expected to miss the entire season due to NCAA ineligibility. This week's developments in the gambling saga make those penalties even more difficult to swallow. A new court filing alleges that DCI officials lied to their own agents to push forward the controversial investigation. The news came a day after a defense attorney accused DCI agent Brian Sanger of conducting a warrantless investigation into underage betting on the Iowa and Iowa State campuses. I knew this thing was a mess, and I knew it was mismanaged, and I knew it was mishandled, Iowa State wrestling coach Kevin Dresser said this week. He continued, I'm glad it's coming to light now and hope all these athletes at Iowa and Iowa State take the state of Iowa to the cleaners. I really do, close quote. Dresser's team is having a strong season, but potentially would be even better had it not lost Paniero Johnson to the gambling investigation. He won a Big 12 championship and was an NCAA championships qualifier last season. It's a good thing Paniero has thick skin and he's been through what he's been through in his life, Dresser said. There were some dark days for him. I had phone calls that morning that spring from three or four of my athletes saying, Coach, I've got some guy here that wants my phone. He's got some piece of paper that says he can take my phone. My advice at that time was, let's get an attorney. But they didn't. It was bully, these kids, at 7 o'clock on a Monday morning, and here we are. Brands' Iowa team, meanwhile, lost All-American Tony Cassiope and Nelson Brands and NCAA qualifiers Abe Assad and Kobe Siebrecht in the gambling probe and resulting NCAA ineligibility. Brand said, the way that is described, basic liberties were infringed upon. He continued, that shouldn't happen in this country. It shouldn't happen in the state of Iowa. The suspended wrestlers are continuing to work out and stay in shape, preparing for the unlikely event that the NCAA will change its mind on their cases. I know one thing. We got a lot of guys upstairs that are ready to go because of what happened, Tom Brand said. He continued, we got guys that were impacted and are still being impacted by that and are still ready to go because of the way we talk to them. You never know what will happen. Be ready, Cassiope. Be ready, Nelson Brands. Be ready, Kobe Seabrick. Be ready, close quote. Prosecutors in Johnson and Story counties have charged 25 current or former Iowa and Iowa State athletes and student managers as a result of the investigation. 16 of those athletes have pleaded guilty, according to the DCI. Many of those athletes pleaded guilty to underage gambling, agreeing to pay a fine of $645. Seven cases are still pending. The investigation and charges have drawn criticism, including from the state's then-top gambling regulator, who told a parent that a lot of the people don't agree with how things were handled. The fact that this week's developments put some heat on the DCI's investigation is small consolation to the Cyclone and Hawkeye athletes who plan to compete at the higher level of college wrestling, but instead are on the sideline. Dresser predicted, though, that the athletes might end up with some compensation after all the dust is settled. He said, I'm glad it came to light. I'm glad that these kids are going to get some justice. There's going to be some checks written, probably big checks. Back to you, Mark.
Chiefs Ravens feature star quarterbacks. Patrick Mahomes and the Kansas City Chiefs took a different route to face the Baltimore Ravens in the AFC Championship game. They're going on the road. After hosting this game five straight seasons, the number three seeds Chiefs had to beat Josh Allen and the Bills in Buffalo and now travel to Baltimore to face Lamar Jackson and the Ravens. The defending Super Bowl champion Chiefs are looking for their third Super Bowl title in 5 years and are trying to become the first team to repeat since Tom Brady and the New England Patriots did it in the 2003 and 4 seasons. They have to get there first. Standing in their way are the number one seed Ravens, who have been playing their best against tough opponents. The Ravens had 11 wins over the winning teams, including 9 by at least 14 points. The Chiefs shut down Tua Tagovailoa and Miami's potent offense in the wild card round and sneaked past the Bills in the Mahomes' first career playoff game on the road. The Ravens rolled to a 34-10 win over Houston after enjoying a first-round bye. They're 3.5-point favorites, according to FanDuel Sportsbook. When the Chiefs have the ball, the Chiefs had the league's sixth-ranked passing offense behind Mahomes and 19th-ranked rushing attack. The Ravens gave up the fewest points per game and were 6th against the pass and 14th against the run. Mahomes is a magician, and what he's been able to do without a legitimate number one wide receiver has been impressive. The two-time NFL and Super Bowl MVP threw for 4,183 yards with 27 touchdowns, a career-high 14 interceptions, and career-low 92.6 passer rating. His receivers dropped 44 passes, most in the league. Mahomes' go-to option still is tight end Travis Kelce. The Ravens have all-pro safety Kyle Hamilton to match up against Kelce, so rookie wideout Rashee Rice, veteran Marquez Valdes-Scantling, and Kadarius Toney, if he's healthy, need to step up. Kelce had 93 catches for 984 yards and 5 TDs in the regular season and caught two scores last week in Buffalo. Rice had 79 receptions for 938 yards and 7 TDs. The Chiefs will rely on running back Isaiah Pacheco to balance the offense. He ran for 935 yards and 7 TDs in the regular season and had 97 yards on 15 carries with one touchdown against the Bills last week. Baltimore's front seven, led by all-pro linebacker Roquan Smith, LB Patrick Queen, and defensive tackle Justin Madubuike, held Houston to 38 yards rushing last week and kept nine teams under 100 this season. Chiefs coach Andy Reid is one of the NFL's all-time great offensive innovators, and he's been known to add a few new wrinkles in big games. Injured all-pro left guard Joe Thuney will force Reid to make some adjustments to the game plan. Ravens defensive coordinator Mike McDonald has become a hot candidate for head coaching positions after Baltimore's defense became the first in NFL history to lead the league in fewest points allowed, sacks, and turnovers. When the Ravens have the ball, the Ravens led the NFL in rushing and were 21st in passing behind the dual threat Jackson. The Chiefs gave up the second fewest points, were fourth against the pass and 18th against the run. Jackson is one of the league's most talented all-around offensive players, so defensive coordinator Steve Spagnuolo unit will have its hands full. The all-pro quarterback and 219th or year 2019 NFL MVP threw for 3,608 yards and 24 touchdowns and also ran for 821 yards and 5 scores. Jackson excelled in the biggest games this season, outplaying Brock Purdy in a rout over San Francisco and tossing 5 touchdown passes in a win over Miami that determined the AFC's number one seed. The Chiefs can expect to see a heavy dose of Gus Edwards, Justice Hill, and Dalvin Cook running the ball and have to watch out for Jackson's scrambles. The trio of backs ran for 129 yards on 31 carries against Houston last week. Jackson led the way with 100-yard rushings. Rookie Zay Flowers led Baltimore with 77 catches for 858 yards and 5 touchdowns. Jackson also has veterans Nelson Aguilar and Odell Beckham Jr. Tight end Mark Andrews is expected to return from an ankle injury, giving Jackson his favorite playmaker. Special teams, two of the best kickers in NFL are in this one. Chief kickers Harrison Butker made 33 of 35 field goals, including all 5 from beyond 50 yards. Ravens 5-time All-Pro Justin Tucker had a down season by his standards, going 32 of 37 on field goals and missing 4 of 5 from 50-plus yards. Ravens punter Jordan Stout had a 39.1-yard net average, while Kansas City's Tommy Townsend had a 41.9-yard net average. The Chiefs use Mecole Hardman and Richie James for returns. Hardman had the longest punt return at 50 yards, and James had the longest kick return at 31. Devin DuVernay is a solid returner for the Ravens. He returned a punt 70 yards. Coaching. Reed is a likely future Hall of Famer. He already has two Super Bowl rings and is the winningest coach in the history of the Chiefs and Eagles. Ravens coach John Harbaugh, a Reed disciple, also has a Hall of Fame caliber resume. He's only had two losing seasons in 16 years with Baltimore and led it to one Super Bowl title. Intangibles are Reed, Mahomes, they're chasing Bill Belichick and Brady. They've got to win four more Super Bowls to match them. Jackson and the Ravens are trying to silence the playoff narrative. The Ravens were 1-3 in the postseason with Jackson before last week's dominant win. Losing this one would be a setback. And let me get to one of these shorter articles in our remaining time. Northern Iowa drops duel to Ohio State. Number 22 Northern Iowa Wrestling lost a tough one to number 5 Oklahoma State, dropping its first Big 12 duel of the season by a score of 22-12 to the Cowboys. The Panthers lost 6 of 10 bouts, with 3 of those being bonus point defeats. In total, UNI faced 5 top 12 wrestlers in Stillwater and lost to 3 of them. However, they won some of the biggest matchups on paper. The headliner of this duel was at 184 pounds between Northern Iowa's number 1 Parker Kikeson and Oklahoma State's number 2 Dustin Plott. Kikeson entered this bout undefeated and left in the same way, trailing 5-4. At one time, Kikeson scored on an escape and 2 takedowns to rally for his 29th consecutive regular season victory. In no uncertain terms, Kikeson has cemented himself as the best in the nation at 184 pounds. Still, those wins were not enough as the Panthers picked up 2 other wins from outside of their top guys. Number 14 Ryder Downey at 157 pounds won over number 18 Teague Davis, while at number 23. And Iowa State, on another wrestling one, thrashes Oklahoma in a road duel. Iowa State began its road trip to Oklahoma in style, winning 37-4 over the Sooners on Friday night. The Cyclones won 9 of their 10 bouts, including 6 being bonus point wins. The first win of that variety came from 133-pound sophomore Evan Frost, winning by major decision 12-2, with 3 takedowns and a reversal heading his efforts against Jace Colzer. Following him was a 141-pound junior Anthony Echemendia with a 23-6 technical fall over Caden Smith. At 157 pounds, freshman Cody Chittum was a late scratch from the lineup. Per an interview conducted by ISU Athletics, coach Kevin Dresser said Chittum suffered a concussion late on Tuesday. In his place was Jason Crazer, who won by decision 2-0 over Jared Hill. Senior David Carr added another bonus point with a win at 165 pounds to his illustrious tenure. This is one at 21-3 victory in 4 minutes 50 seconds over Mannix Morgan. That was followed by a 174-pound sophomore, MJ Gayton's seventh pin of the year, before 184-pound senior Will Feedkamp added a major decision victory to the scoreboard. This was on dual paper that Iowa State had the clear advantage, and it showed to the end. The most difficult test was for the senior heavyweight, younger Batsita, facing number 9, Josh Heidesselman, as he was in all season. Batsita rolled to a 14-4 victory, including a highlight reel throw from a neutral position to set the tone early and cap off the duel. And that's the end of our sports. And that brings us to the end of the Des Moines Register for today. I'm Mark Morrison, and my partner at the Marcus phone has been Bobby Bailey. Earlier, you heard Seth Anderson and Ella Gibson. You can listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Support for today's reading comes from the Des Moines Register, Iowa Public Radio, Iowa PBS, and bensoundmusic.com. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.